nothing's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues.
Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show, and one of the things we will talk about today is that on this day in history, the great James Baldwin passed away, as did Gwendolyn Brooks on the same day. In 2000, she died of cancer. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1950, one of the great poets in the United States ever. They both died on this day, and we'll reflect on a little bit of her as well. But we are going to talk about, to start with James Baldwin and what he has meant for all of us in this country and what his legacy means. We're talking with William Melvin Kelly, novelist and short story writer and author of When I Was a Teenager, one of my favorite books ever, A Different Drummer. He wrote Dem and A Drop of Patience. He's a winner of the Annis Field Wolf Award for 2008 for Lifetime Achievement, and teaches fiction writing still at Sarah Lawrence College. William Melvin Kelly, welcome. Good to have you on the show. Really is an honor to have you with us.
Thank you for being thank me. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you with us. It really is.
No, my life is a show.
Well,
thank you for being my guest this morning, Mark.
And Reggie Harris is with us, poet, incredible poet, originally from Baltimore, Maryland, recipient of the 2000 Cave Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize for his book, Autogeography. And he is a poetry in the branches coordinator and director for Poets House in New York City. And Reggie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Mark. Thank you. It's good to be home.
and William Kelly.
I hear him so good. Anyway.
So let's talk a bit about the power of James Baldwin. We'll hear some clips of him and things he said, but I think that right now there's a battle going on in Harlem, as I understand, William Kelly, to ensure that that the school that James Baldwin went to is named after him, because there's no real monuments to this man, and people don't realize, I think, the power of James Baldwin had on this entire nation. As a novelist, as a writer, as a thinker, as a black man, as a gay man, stepping out so early in his life. William Kelly?
Oh, I don't know too much about that. I know he was a great essayist. I guess I was thinking back. He was the first one who began to articulate what was happening with African Americans in terms of the mainstream. I'm literary terms. He was a really great essayist. Not quite as good a novelist, but and his heart was in the right places. And he was brave, because he was coming out. He was coming out. And his old being was coming out. He couldn't be in the closet. He'd been out probably all his life. We have people like that. Everybody knows that they're gay, and they used to have some relationship to the church, especially the musical part. And that's just the way they are. But I don't think the mainstream had ever seen someone like that. He was on a par in terms of gay behavior of someone like Truman Capote.
That's interesting, right?
Very good, very keen comparison. Somebody should write something about Truman Capote. I think you probably know Truman Capote. Yes, go on.
And Reggie, your thoughts on what William was saying?
Well, what I tend to think about is how, there's certain writers or there's certain artists who sort of fall out of favor and then, have to be resuscitated or rescued. And Baldwin seems always to be with us. Whenever something, happens, particularly around, issues of race, let's say Trayvon Martin or, the election of Barack Obama, there's a Baldwin quote. There's something that he wrote or there's something that he said that seems absolutely perfectly relevant to the times. He was, a product of of his times of the civil rights movement in the 50s and the 60s. But the things he was talking about America and its interrelationship, the sort of twisted relationship that we have, that the races have in this country, remain absolutely prescient and applicable to the day. So he's always with us. He's in the air. And one other thing that's sort of interesting is that there's a lineage there, because, you know, one of his teachers at DeWitt Clinton in Harlem was the poet County Cullen. And there's a group of writers that were African-American writers that were at Harvard that came down to New York for Baldwin's funeral and created this group called the Dark Room. And now one of those original members, is now the poet laureate of the United States, Natasha Fetherway. So he's got this lineage. He goes back to the Harlem Renaissance. He was, you know, so important in the 50s and 60s, and his legacy continues on. He's just so central to America. I won't even just say Black America. I'll say America. I mean, you know, when you think about particularly his essays, I mean, I think if you look at, you know, in the 19th century, the American essay was Emerson. And in the 20th century, if you want to say the American essay or the American essayist, was Baldwin. So
that's interesting mantle to lay on Baldwin. Now, let's talk about that for a minute. The James Baldwin, I think, because, you know, we have a tendency, especially with Black writers and writers of color, to kind of box people into he was the great African American writer,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to what you were just saying, Reggie, and I think which is really critical, William, just the idea that Baldwin wasn't a great African American writer. He may have been, as Reggie said, one of the great essayists of the 20th century. Period.
Yeah, sure. I think that's absolutely true. Well, I mean, you know, he was everybody's a rich character. At first, you had the Renaissance, and I think to a certain extent, their aspiration was acceptance, you know. But then here came along Richard Wright, and, you know, that was the essence of the protest novel. And then came along Baldwin, and he was saying, well, there's more to this than just, you know, what Richard Wright has given us. There are more subtle things going on, and the programming of us as a minority is much deeper, you know, than most people want to realize. And then he led to the 60s, and there were a lot of, you know, writers, including myself, and Baraka, and, you know, everybody like that. So he was really, and a lot of these things also can be judged in whether or not they're being read by white people. You know, there's a certain lag there. Very often African-American people will perceive it first, and then Euros will come along and perceive it, you know. And then that's when it gets big, like something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Reggie, you want to pick up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that he wanted, you know, as broad an audience as possible for his work. And, you know, he, you know, more than once talked about his love of Henry James and Dostoevsky, you know, who, last time I looked, they're not Black writers, but I could be wrong. I think that he really did want to be, you know, out of any kind of box. I mean, I don't think he, you know, of course now, you know, of course we call him, you know, a Black writer and a gay writer and all this other stuff, but he never, you know, liked those boxes. I mean, I that's true, because it sort of, it limits you. You know, I mean, how can you write in
a box?
You know,
I mean, I guess you could say that if, you know, the New Yorker stands for anything, it does stand for style. You know, most of the writers who write for the New Yorker have, you know, really great style. And he was one of them.
Yeah.
And, as you know, even just that would be some type of objective standard, you know, that you could judge him by. You know, his writing stood up
And it's interesting because, writing there in a way there isn't, but there's no African-Americanisms in his writing. He's always operating at a level of high standard English. And I think we had struggled to get that far. Wright was, it was happening all along, really. Starting from even Chestnut, who was writing way back in the 18th century, or the 19th century. We always aimed high, But there was a spark in his language.
You said, did you say a spark?
Sparkle.
Sparkle. A sparkle. Right. Sparkle. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It was like it was shimmery.
Yeah.
It was shiny,
Yeah.
What he wrote about Elijah Muhammad. I mean, he made that understand to the population, which is a hard thing to do because you have a man who's talking about white people were created by Dr. Yacoub collecting all the albinos from Africa and taking them to Malta and developing the white race. He's made that seem reasonable for all of us.
But I think it's quite an accomplishment, yes.
So, I mean, that particular essay,
he was sweet. He said, let me just talk about him as a man. He was a very sweet man. Kind of like Langston Hughes in the same kind of way. One of the reasons I guess I came to live in Harlem, because there was something about Harlem, and what came out of it was a tremendous love for African American people themselves. Like, for instance, maybe we don't feel that Richard Wright might have had coming through Chicago, Baldwin was like that. I want to tell this personal story. The first day I met him was the first day that A Different Drummer came out. It was June 8, 1966. And I had a lunch with a man named Jim Silverman, with a B. And he was running a magazine called the Dial Press, and it was also running kind of a subsidiary of Delacorte Press. I think it was Dial Magazine, too. And he published something of mine, so that's how I knew him. And he published some stuff by Baldwin, too. And he took me to lunch that day. And we were walking down Madison Avenue, and up 52nd came James Baldwin. They hailed each other, and he introduced me. And, of course, I knew he was writing. And he said, well, how's it going? I said, I'm reviewing the Times today, but they didn't like it too much, so they couldn't understand what it was about. And he said, in just the sweetest way, he said, that's all right, baby. It doesn't matter what they say. And I always remember that. He was very kind. He was just a very kind man. I had a fuss with him one time, but I won't even tell you about that.
You can't.
It shows my dumbness. I was arguing with him about whether or not a homosexual man could be as good a mother as a woman.
Oh God!
And he felt, of course, he could, and because he had raised all his brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And I was at him. He got a little missed. I got a little missed. But we made up. I think it was the last time I saw him. What was that? 67, something like that. Anyway. Mm-hmm. But he was always sweet. He was just a nice guy. He was a nice man. A nice man. I think he did believe in America or wanted to.
Yes.
But I find telling that he basically lived in France. From the 60s on. I'm sure he found it very hard to live in America. It can be very hard, Just every day is a day to day. It's just like the Frisking stuff. The store Frisking. I mean, people bought the things with the money, and money's supposed to be the god, but still, You know, here they are calling the cops and saying that, you know, two people have left our store, and, you know, and then, you know, all that. And that's just an annoying thing. You know, you get so tired. I'm 75 now. You get so tired of the race thing. Especially when you find out there's no such thing as race. You know, and then you say, what is this, all this for? And it turns out to be about the money. But
I think what you're outlining, William, is so true. And I think that in many ways Reggie Baldwin's kind of writing mirrored everything William's saying in terms of both his love and his frustration. About where we are, and about the internal stuff in religion in the black world, or whether it had to do with what the Western world did to black folks and why he was in exile. So I think
that.
Go ahead, Reggie. Very quick. We're going to go to break. Take us there.
Yeah, because I mean, Mr. Kelly is right. I mean, one of the things about racism is it's just sort of every day. It's like this death by a thousand cuts. That something, you know, something happens, and well, is it because, you know, I'm a jerk, or is it because of the skin that I wear that this person's treated me like this? Or, you know, I mean, as you know now, you know, here in New York, I mean, we won't even talk about Stop and Frisk, but just, you know, the fact that you go into, I mean, Macy's or some other store to buy something and you're looked at and, you know, sort of like, how can you afford to buy this watch for your parents or something like that? It's just insane. And it's just one thing after another, just sort of slowly grinds you down. So, you know, I cannot blame him for leaving the country, because, you know, if you can, you know, do it, you know, just for a while, just so you can breathe.
So we have to take a very brief break, and we're going to come right back. We're going to go out for a moment here as we go out to this quick break. We're hearing James Baldwin sing, "O Precious Lord." this is a precious thing. Here we go. We'll be right back with our conversation about James Baldwin.
Take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I'm tired, I'm weak, I'm worn through storm, through the night, lead me on to
bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're playing Ray Charles right there, something he made in 1966, because that was when he was given a 5-year suspended sentence and a $10,000 fine for being convicted of possessing both heroin and marijuana, and wrote the song Busted. We are here with our two guests reflecting on the life of James Baldwin, who passed away, actually it was the other day, December the 1st. We're talking with William Melvin Kelly, a noted novelist, author of A Different Drummer, Damn a Drop of Patience, now teaching at the Sarah Lawrence College. Reggie Harris, who is a poet from Baltimore, who won the Cave Cannon Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize for Poetry for Autogeography, and is the Poetry and Branches Coordinator and directs the Poets House in New York City. 410-319-8888. Our phones are working today? Good. Oh, they are working. 410-319-8888. You can join us in this conversation about James Baldwin. I'd like to pick up one of the things about, again, when I think of Baldwin, I think about all the things he did that were really at the edge, but in an important sense, whether it was how he kind of loved the kind of Malcolm X, but also loved Martin Luther King and had the power of both. He went through his support of Core and SNCC, his taking on Kennedy, blaming them for what happened in Birmingham and people like in Eastland, and did all that. At the same time, he wrote books way ahead of his time about being a homosexual when nobody was even talking about the word gay rights in America, and his fearlessness and his thinking.
I just have to say that I find that very interesting that the first book he published was Giovanni's Room.
Right.
As opposed to Another Country or something like that. So that he was really in the vanguard in the gay lesbian thing.
And I think he was that in many ways in things that he did and he wrote and said, and even his kind of taking on the idea why he walked away from the church and why he walked away from religion, but never really condemning it, other than saying how he, because he also said that the other side was he thought the church in many ways helped fuse a movement. I mean, so Reggie, there was a complexity about Baldwin that I've always loved. Reggie, and then we let Reggie jump in, and then go with him. Go ahead.
Hello. I think that sort of goes back to that notion of that we were talking about before about not wanting to be put in a box. Essays and fiction, and he wrote a couple of plays. He did a screenplay of the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was never produced, but he did it. It was just all these different things. It's just sort of incredible. And you're right about the church. He sort of left the church, but the church never left him, because all of his essays have that sort of that power, that rhetorical power of biblical language and the language of the black church. It's all the way through. I mean, that's sort of the core of his work. And one of the other things, too, it's sort of interesting, is that, yes, he wrote Giovanni's Room, and, that's sort of a gay novel, but then if you look at, say, the book after that, Another Country, the character there, he's gay now, but now he's with a woman, he's bisexual, even his characters he didn't put in boxes. There's sort of this fluidity that runs through his characters, that runs through his life. It's sort of like, I want to be me. I want to be free. He's always talking about freedom, and it's the freedom to be who you are. And that's, I think, what makes him and his work live on, and that everyone that wants to be themselves goes back to Baldwin, and they hear that voice urging America just to let people be who they are, just to live, and not force them into, ghettos or force them into particular positions. Just let us be who we are.
William?
That's true. That's very true. Ask me a question.
Well, let me do this. Let me get it.
I'm the one who knows, so ask me a question.
No, it's cool. Let me do this. Let me get a quick caller in here, and then I'm going to read a quote that we can play with in a moment from Baldwin. And Charles, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I'm up in the morning calling you from Los Angeles, California.
Oh, great.
So listen, I was actually in Baltimore doing some Baldwin stuff back at the library. We met.
Oh, right. Charles Hughes, I do remember you were here. Yeah. Correct, yes.
So I just wanted to jump in and say, like everyone, that I believe that Baldwin is the greatest writer, American writer, in the 20th century. I like to say it out loud and clear. And I also don't want to be remiss that this is also the 50th anniversary of James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, mm-hmm. Which is a book that actually sits on the Library of Congress list of books of one of the top 50 books, and was a game changer. And I think to celebrating the 26th anniversary of Baldwin's passing since it was December 1st, one of the ways that I think that we can really begin to help ignite Baldwin's fire is to encourage people to start reading books like The Fire Next Time. And if you really want to understand Baldwin from my point of view, is I think the best quote that I'll give you comes from his book, Nobody Knows My Name. And he simply says that human freedom is a complex, difficult, and a private thing. If we can liken life for a minute like a furnace, then freedom is the fire that burns away illusion. And I think that's one really good way to really understand and focus in on Baldwin. So I appreciate all your comments. I just wanted to share that.
Oh, Charles, thank you so much for getting up so early and joining us here. I deeply appreciate that. And I appreciate the work you've done on Baldwin and the things that you've done. William, would you like to jump in on that one? William, can you hear us?
Yeah, I couldn't hear him very well.
I
can't agree with him that he was the greatest American writer of the 20th century just because I am.
I love that. We will keep that quote forever, William. I like that.
I can't write essays. I make my essays into fiction. I think that's where, you know, he was not a fiction writer. I just, you know, for me, his fiction doesn't work. I don't know. I shouldn't say that because he's dead, I suppose.
But
as I say, I would, you know, I put him up there with Melkin and Mencken and, you know, E.B. White and all the great essayists that are considered to be great essayists in America. You know, and probably because he's dealing with a more important subject. I mean, among other things, he's dealing about this race thing, you know, that, just clubbing us all in the head. And he got out there and dealt with it and was very brave. I think he's one of the bravest writers in the 20th century in America. But, you know, I have to discount his fiction. I'm sorry.
And, Reggie, I think that's why, in some ways, it's so important for us to keep pondering what he did and said and wrote, because it's so relevant for where we are now. I remember.
Well, he was our spokesman for a while. I mean, he was on television. They gave him an hour, I think, on primetime TV, if I'm not mistaken, with CBS.
Yeah.
And he made a speech about, you know, race in America. And who knows who ever did that before? I don't think that ever happened.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's sort of interesting how the culture has changed in the fact that, yeah, you could turn on the TV and there was, you know, Baldwin talking and all these other, you know, great writers, you know, and not even a small segment, as you mentioned, but these sort of long, expansive, you know, discussions. And, you know, the influence that had on the culture, where you could see this man and hear him, you know, expound on the issues of the day. It's just sort of extraordinary. You know, before there was this, you know, too many cable channels, if you will, and too much information going through. I mean, and that was incredibly important. I mean, to remember as a kid, sort of sitting there going, "Who is this guy? You know, who is this? This is incredible." You know, but then that was also the times when, you know, your parents called you and said, "Hey, look, there's a black person on TV." It was riveting, and he was riveting, you know, too, because he had this, you know, amazing presence and those huge eyes and the sort of the way that he, you know, talked and sort of cut through all of the rhetoric that people were giving
was one of the things of the time that. There were two people who, when they came on TV, you would come and see them because you would be amazed at things that they would say. And one of them, of course, was Malcolm. And then the other one was Baldwin, you know. You know, you sit in front of the TV and you say, "Wow, you hear what that black man said to that white man?" You know, we never had that before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We never had anybody come out and say, "Well, you're just the devil. You know, I can't trust anything you say."
Yeah.
I mean, that was like, you know, we were sitting there, "Wow, did he really call him a devil?" You know, it was like something you couldn't even believe, you know. And that was what Baldwin was like. But I could see, I remember even in that TV show, I remember his speech. He was very uncomfortable in that role.
So,
you know, there was not a man who was self-ambitious or anything like that. He was, you know, it's like God had given him the voice to say these things, and he had to say them. But he would rather have been, I suppose, you know, in the south of France, sitting in the sun.
On that note, we have to kind of wind this part of our conversation down, and I think we have to come back to, and we will, as we think about this year coming, which will be the 90th anniversary of his birth coming up in 2014. And we'll be sure to prepare things for that.
That's Baldwin?
Yes, coming up in the next,
okay.
In 2014.
Wow, that's great.
So William Melvin Kelly, author of one of my favorite books ever, A Different Drummer, and Reginald Harris, a dear friend and great poet, Thank you both so much for joining us to reflect on James Baldwin.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a very brief break. We're about to listen to, on our break, Connie Boswell. She was a New Orleans singer. Pete Kelly's Blues is what you're listening to. And she was born on this day. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we go to Iran and talk about the latest deal and what all that means.
You heard me sing a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. When I looked, the moon had turned to gold.